This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast for the 2nd of August 2016, a podcast about Apache Hadoop and the surrounding ecosystem for anyone working with or investigating big data. My name is Dane, and here is my co-host, Jon.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Hello, Jon. I'm very well.
Well, you should be, shouldn't you?
I should be very well, and we'll come to why in a little bit. So, what's your last couple of weeks been like?
Well, happily, it's vacation time, and a lot of the customers are on vacation, so we have a bit of free time as well, right? So I'm filling that in, as I did last time. Studying, and more studying. And the last couple of weeks, I've been diving deeper on the actual machine learning algorithms, because I've been doing a lot of showing people how you can use the tools to do machine learning. But in my new job, I also need to be able to explain why a certain algorithm is better than the other one for a certain data set.
Okay.
And that was kind of knowledge. I kind of knew a bit about it, but not really enough.
So have you been doing all of this within, you know, one particular technology, Spark, or have you been kind of, is it been more generic, more agnostic?
It's more generic, because Spark, if you really think about Spark, you're really talking about the RDDs, the resilient data sets that allow you to do the big data size analysis, number crunching across multiple nodes. That's what the Spark layer does for you. Mm-hmm. Spark ML is then the thing that exposes the machine learning algorithms. But basically, most of those come from Python, from NumPy and scikit-learn and stuff like that. So in this case, since I just want to dig into what do these algorithms do, how long do they take, what are the weaknesses and the strengths, mm-hmm. I just went to straight Python with the NumPy things. And there's a nice course on EDX, which I'm taking, of course. And I'm just going through that and purely on the Python.
You do love yourself some EDX, don't you?
I think it's a very nice... I've given publicity before, but yeah. I really like their approach, the way they do it, the accessibility of it all.
Yeah,
it's a very nice platform, and a lot of big companies, including my employer, Microsoft, are giving free courses there, and more often than not, the quality is pretty high.
Yeah.
And as long as I can learn something, I'm happy.
I think we've got a little bit of time, so because my section is going to be much shorter.
Slacker.
So, I know. So, what's your 5-minute synopsis of machine learning algorithms? What are the highlights? What are the most commonly used ones? What's that sort of story look like?
Well, it kind of depends on if you're learning them or using them. Because mm-hmm. usually if you're learning them or you're going to prepare a beginner's lecture, you're going to start with linear regression, maybe some gradient descent. And that's basically because the mathematics behind it is, well, not easy, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm learning now is that pretty much anything you want to solve, you just do random forest, and that always works the best. Now, obviously, it's not that easy as either, right? But the thing is that in all the things I've learned until now, the really beginner stuff, just to have a kind of a feel of the scene, you get this... maybe alternating these squares in the recommendation engine, you get a linear regression, and that's about it. And now going deeper, that's when k-means clustering comes in, k-neighbors, random forests, and the normal decision trees, of course, as well. And yeah, that's again the next step up. Now, is this what's being used out there? I don't think so. I don't know. I'm not there yet, but I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
This is just one leg up for generic results.
Yeah.
But if you can go to a very specific recommendation for, I don't know, give me an example, predictive maintenance or whatever. Mm-hmm. We had an example last week. Some guys came to the office and they explained about the scheduling problem. You have X people doing Y jobs in Z different places with all kinds of limitations, whatever. How do you can make a schedule that everybody's used to the optimal thing? And they were using an algorithm I'd never heard about.
Okay.
And probably that's a continuation, a further specialization of another algorithm. And then it gets the name of the guy that invented it. I'm totally blanking on the name now. But that's what happens most often when you actually go to a production environment. They have a specific algorithm that's really fine-tuned to a specific thing they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's what they use then. Now, from my point of view, and yours as well, I guess, as a pre-sales person, as an architect person, you're more occupied giving the customer options in generic directions, if you like.
Yeah.
Classification, yeah. Supervised, non-supervised, and... So that's, well, I already knew how to do that. With what I'm doing now, I can go a little bit deeper. But in the end, it's always going to be the customer with that very important domain knowledge, because that's always a thing that I and you are missing.
Yeah,
that's what they need to really make this specific choice of the algorithm to use, or maybe build their own.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least, as you say, extend an existing algorithm that goes into their area more specifically.
Yeah. Well, maybe extending isn't necessary, because some of these things you can really tune. There's a lot of tuning parameters in there as well. But as again, usually I see them using something very specific I've never heard about.
Okay.
But it's a bit discouraging, but still.
But if in doubt, Random Forest.
Random Forest apparently. But I just finished a Random Forest lecture today, so that's why it's fresh in my mind, I guess. But it's an easy one to use. It's fast, and it's actually easily parallelizable as well. So even for that's the advantage for Random Forest on top of the normal decision trees. The Random Forest takes up trees that are smaller than the big one, so you can easily parallelize, fire up a million trees, let every node do a little bit, come back, give the average, and that's the one that wins.
Yeah, I mean that's the big area, isn't it? That's where taking out your traditional algorithms and that sort of things, making them easily parallelizable is part of the effort that many of these projects go through, because that's the key differentiator.
Yeah, you kind of have to figure out which of these algorithms actually do parallelize easily and which aren't easily parallelized. And another choice, for example, is that some models take very long to train but then score very quickly.
Yeah.
Others train very quickly, but score very long.
Yeah.
So it's and all, and that's the kind of depth I'm learning now.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously, if you've got something that's doing real-time decision making, you want something that's got a very low latency for its scoring.
Exactly.
You can't have something in your real-time loop that takes a long time to actually reach a decision.
Yeah, but if you only want to train the model once a day, then who cares if it runs 6 hours?
Yeah, very true. Yep. Very true.
So basically, that's been what I've been doing the last couple of weeks.
All right. Excellent.
So your turn.
Yeah. So my last 2 weeks, very different. Well, sort of the same and sort of different. Sort of the same because I've also been on holiday. Sort of different because I've been on a tiny island in French Polynesia with the kind of internet access that you probably had going back several decades, and a dial-up is essentially what it felt like, and that was pretty much for the whole island. So my last 2 weeks have been spent, instead of doing exciting machine learning stuff, doing things like snorkeling, reading, having a pina colada or two, and that's pretty much been it. It's been absolutely amazing, thoroughly fantastic.
That does sound very much like a decision tree, really.
Yeah, yeah. if no internet, then snorkel with whale sharks.
Oh, whale sharks.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. The they are the largest fish in the sea.
Sharks aren't mammals, right?
Correct. Well, whale sharks specifically, largest fish. Anyway, very, very. I would thoroughly recommend it to anybody. About an hour away from Tahiti. Anyway, so yeah, my last 2 weeks, lots of fun, very enjoyable, but very little big data. Of course, always thinking about big data, but very little actual big data.
Yeah, and as usual, I wasn't invited.
No, sorry about that.
No, you're not.
You're right, I'm not. And that was it.
All right, well, that's fast and quick. That's twice the same thing. And that's a good thing, because in the main section, we actually have an interview, and Dave's going to explain more about that in a second, but I do want to apologize for the audio quality. Up until now, the podcast has been very much spared of the chaos that Skype gods can wreak, something like that. However, when we recorded the interview, you're going to hear in the main section, we actually did have a couple of dropouts, quality was bad, and I was able to fix up most of it, but you will, dear listener, have to suffer a small disruption at the end of the interview, which I couldn't totally smooth over. So my apologies there.
No problem. So it's one of those things. Occasionally the Skype gods smite you down, and they did in this case. But Nevertheless, there's some interesting stuff coming up. So you're about to go into an interview with John Mertig from the Open Data Platform Initiative. And we're going to talk to him about all of the exciting things that the ODPI is actually doing for big data. So some of you may have heard of the Open Data Platform Initiative before. It might be new to others of you out there. But it's quite an interesting area of standardization around Hadoop and big data. So hopefully you'll learn something new and interesting. I know I certainly did. And yes, enjoy. So, welcome back. We're here today with John Mertig, the Director of Program Management for ODPI and the Open Mainframe Project. Unfortunately, John, we're not here to talk about Open Mainframe today, but we are here to talk about ODPI. So, first of all, welcome to the Roaring Elephant podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite. Glad to be here.
So, do you want to give the audience a little introduction to you, who you are, where you came from?
Yeah, so I've been around open source pretty much my whole career. I've been a part of a number of organizations, Sugar CRM, I led community there for a number of years, then got involved in their partner and channel programs, and then also spent a stint at Bitnami working on helping build them up a partner program as well. I've been a longtime contributor in open source, so I grew up a developer, contributed a bunch to a number of PHP projects and the core PHP project itself. And then recently here, joined the Linux Foundation and helping kick off and get ODPI going from a leadership, business, and governance standpoint.
Fantastic. Okay, so... You know, high level, what is the ODPI, first of all? And kind of follow on to that is why should, you know, someone using or consuming Hadoop, why should they care?
So in a nutshell, ODPI, it's simply a nonprofit organization. And our commitment is to simplify and standardize the big data ecosystem. The challenge that we've seen in the market, and this is we've talked to a number of different consumers, both from the distro side, but really more importantly downstream, application vendors who are building solutions that hook into Hadoop, systems integrators and solutions providers, and end customers, is there's a lot of great innovation going, but it doesn't always work congruently with one another. And there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of incompatibilities as you move between distros. There's a ton of different projects. And so our real focus is how can we help simplify this? And how can we ensure that when anybody is approaching a Hadoop cluster, there is a set of expectations that downstream consumer, that ISV, that end user can expect this cluster to have, which seems like a very obvious thing when you say it out loud, but surprisingly, there's a lot of confusion here. I did a talk here recently at Apache Big Data in Vancouver, and the one analogy I threw out there was, you know, the Apache projects for a long time have been great about producing the peanuts and chocolate, if you would, for Hadoop. But the end consumer, you know, anybody downstream is they're wanting a Reese's cup. You know, they're wanting it put together, but they're also just wanting those properties, the expectations, how it's put together, what the package looks like, what the consistency looks like. And we're here not to package. I mean, that's still a job that the distributions will always do. We never really want to get into that space. But to ensure that each distribution's Reese's cup has sort of those base level properties of what a Reese's cup is, that's where we're at. And that's really where our focal point is.
Okay, got it. So first question, I guess, would be ODPI, Open Data Platform Initiative.
Yes.
You know, anything particularly, I know initially it was called the ODP, Open Data Platform, and then the I was kind of tacked onto the end. You want to talk a little bit about ODPI and the core of how that came to be?
Yeah, so, I mean, yes, ODP was initially launched as a vendor consortium between a number of the large vendors of that time, so Pivotal, IBM, Hortonworks, and a handful of other organizations. And, you know, a lot of the initial thrust there was, hey, if we could standardize on the contents of what a Hadoop distribution could be, we could certainly help simplify lives for ISVs downstream. And this was actually a lot of the thrust of the original of the Apache Big Top project as well. The big piece of feedback that came from that announcement, and I think some of the still prominent naysayers have pushed back is, you know, hey, that is by making everything, you know, very canonical, is that really helping solve the problem? And is that more stifling innovation than it is promoting it? And, you know, we at that point, the Linux Foundation helped get engaged there all these organizations are looking to say, hey, how can we get this open source out of a vendor controlled ecosystem, but instead shift it over to a vendor neutral? And that's it's a very as you say it, it's a subtle difference, but there's a huge, huge difference in practice. When you get into a vendor neutral situation, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the competing interests, the corporate product interest, all of that sort of diminishes, and the real true community value, you know, starts to rise up. And some of the first things that when we got involved that we recognized were, we need to make sure that this is an inclusive ecosystem so that as others joins, there's opportunities to join within there. We needed to reduce a lot of the confusion around, you know, where we fit with the rest of the Hadoop ecosystem. So the biggest piece of feedback that we got is, how does this fit with Apache? Is this in conflict with it? Are we trying to take over Apache? Are we trying to take over all these levels of all this development? In which none of that's true. But that was a very, you know, that was an honest conversation that we had to have. And we came back with it and saying, no, of course not. Let's try to establish how. Let's establish how we fit into this whole, you know, sphere. And where we saw ourselves is in this big gap between, you know, vendors taking product to market. And when I say vendors, I mean, you know, the Hortonworks, the IBMs, the Clouderas, you know, the Hadoop distro vendors, them taking product to market. And these Apache upstream projects, which are great on building technical innovation, but getting that longer feedback loop from the end customer and the ISV has been a challenge, because the way you play effectively in the Apache ecosystem is through code. And if those organizations don't have the best ability to contribute code, it's tough for them to have a seat at the table. It's tough for them to help get that feedback up. So ODPI sits as in a useful position there. And we work less in the concept of code. I mean, we don't own IP. We don't write code. I mean, we write tests, but I mean, we're not writing big chunks of Apache code here. But what we are doing is we're helping pull together these ISV use cases and giving a mechanism for that to flow back upstream. So traditionally before, you had to flow this to your vendor, and your vendor, you know, they're going to prioritize based upon what their product needs are. Here, this gives a vendor neutral way for that to flow upstream, and it gives these organizations a seat at the table where they may not have had before.
Got it. Okay, so I mean, you mentioned that there had been, some criticism of the ODPI sort of initially. I mean, one of the perhaps more prominent, bits of criticism came from Cloudera, who are not, I believe, a current member of the ODPI and have been somewhat scathing about it. Any kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, all of the criticism is that they gave us initially was extremely valid. It echoed a lot of the criticism the community gave. Is this vendor controlled open source? Is this in conflict with the Apache Software Foundation? What really is the value we can drive? We're working to resolve that, and I think we've done a number of that. I mean, moving them to the Linux Foundation, I know, has been a huge step. We recently announced a sponsorship for the Apache Software Foundation, which has helped sort of cement how we look at ourselves in relation to the work done there. The rest of it, honestly, is just going to come down to when it makes the most business sense for these companies, for the outlying companies to engage. And Cloudera is not the only one. I mean, Amazon, Google, there's another number of other companies that have Hadoop distributions and are investing in that path that we're in discussion with. I will sort of point out, and this is one of the misnomers, I think, that many who are in this circle look at things with. Hadoop distro vendors really aren't our primary audience. They validate what we're doing, but our primary audience is ISVs and end users. So yes, having more of the distro vendors at the table is a validation step for us, but they're not going to be our primary consumer of what we're doing.
So are you basically saying here that maybe expect is a large word, but that you expect the ISV and the end users to kind of demand from the distributors that they become part of ODPI, or else?
I could certainly see that as a path, right? I mean, they're the ones who are feeling the pinch right now. Mm-hmm. They're having to spread their resources. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been in their shoes. I've been in the alliances space. And there's two challenges that you run into with a business, a technical alliance. One is on just the go-to-market strategy, which, it is what it is. But then the second is on the technical piece. And the technical piece is usually the part that is actually the most costly for an organization, because you're talking, dedicated developer time. It's an ongoing commitment. There's QA commitments that come in there. That is a large sunk cost that's hard to get out. Mm-hmm. And frankly, as an organization, you're always leery of making that investment unless, you're going to see that return.
Yeah.
And if I'm running a big ISV, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to do the ones where I think are going to make my largest area of return. So I'm going to probably do a Cloudera, I'm probably going to do a Hortonworks, and I'm probably going to do an IBM. But even then, I mean, that's a lot for an organization to mm-hmm. undertake.
Yeah.
I mean, it just really, really is. I mean, that's, just owning the business. I mean, not to bore your audience with all of those details, but it's not as trivial as you think. And certainly on the technical side, if all of these are entirely divergent, or even a reasonable amount divergent, where I'm having to have specialized resources mm-hmm. dealing with each of them, that's adding more cost than saying I'm not going outside of the circle.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're not boring the audience, because our audience is primarily in the technical field, architects and deployment people, so they're facing this every day.
Yeah. I didn't want to go too much down the business road, because that sometimes, it turns on the headphones for everybody. It's like, okay, I'm done with you now.
Yeah. Now, when you talked about the membership of the ODPI, you were talking about Hortonworks, Pivotal, and a couple others. Do you have any representatives from the end user point of view then? How do they get a say in the whole ODPI thing?
Yeah, we're starting to build that presence up. I mean, okay. One of the initial ones was GE Software. We have a few others in the pipe. We have a few others that we aren't overly public about. One of them, a large North American automotive vendor. And there's a couple different paths where they've seen a nice path to engage. I think one of them is just helping elevate their use cases through our ecosystem. One of the things that we've been working to establish is an end user advisory board, mm-hmm. Where we can help present what we're doing from a specification level and some of the areas of focus, and start to just really understand some of their challenges. These end users, the interesting thing that we're seeing a lot of these end users is, even if they're fairly down, you know, moving down the Hadoop path, and they have some stuff into production, they're still wrestling with big data to a degree. Mm-hmm. I think one of the recent statistics that I saw within there is from Forrester, and this is from January. They said, you know, that between 60% and 73% of data that enterprises have access to goes unused. Mm-hmm. for BI and analytics.
Yep.
Right? So there's that is, you know, there's still a lot out there. There's still a ton, and that's just talking at the enterprise level. We're not even talking in the next, that mid-market level, right? So there's a lot of space to be covered here. Everybody who's listening to this knows Hadoop is a very powerful technology, and it's still under-penetrated of where it should be. Why is that? And for us, we're dedicated to figuring that out, and how can we help that?
Yeah. Now, you're putting together kind of a recommendation of what an ODP-compliant platform should contain. Now, I may be wrong, but last time I looked, that was only a few components of a full-fledged used Hadoop stack. So mm-hmm. on the one hand, I can see why that's what that is. You don't want to enforce everything, because I would imagine that would be bad for innovation. But on the other hand, how do you guys decide what's enough to have a stable base that's stable and big enough for the ISVs, application developers, to have something they can test only once and then deploy everywhere?
So part of our design philosophy of how we approach this, you know, there's a couple pieces, and some of them are obvious. You know, one is, you know, we're not trying to own any development work. Everything's ASF upstream. But I think the biggest piece in there is we want to direct our investments in time of what's going to impact the largest number of big data deployments. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, it is no lie that there are probably 100 or so Apache Hadoop related ASF projects, and that's not even counting the ones, you know, that are sponsored by companies but live outside of ASF. And I think the statistic I heard, there's a new ASF Hadoop project that comes out of incubations every 6 weeks, right? Yeah. So that train is not stopping.
That's a good thing, right?
That's an amazing thing, right? I mean, that's just saying this is the hot area to be. But you know, it's always going to be the uphill challenge of, do we want to wrap our hands around every piece of this and try to solve everybody's problems? No. But if we can focus on the things that are going to have the greatest amount of impact, and where we started was really just that base level. I mean, we rewound and said, hey, if you're going to start anywhere, you have to start at what traditionally is called Hadoop Core, you know, HDFS, Yarn, MapReduce. And let's just get some base level expectations, you know, aligned there. I mean, part of the exercise was, hey, we have to figure out how as an organization we operate. Then the other half is we just need a base to work from. And really that sort of helps also guide our philosophy. We're not going to be in the business of directing where innovation goes. We are more in the business of directing base level expectations. So think of the analogy of we're not building ceilings, we're building floors, right? Mm-hmm. We're not saying where vendors can go from there. And matter of fact, our specifications very clearly state, you know, that vendors have the ability to innovate from here. We just want to have that base level floor. And so as we look to expand the scope, and this is all driven through our membership, mm-hmm. And we have, you know, procedures, policies in place here that our members actually direct on what gets included and release contents, you know, from a meta level. And we have a governance structure in there that helps define that. You know, we're looking really at that floor. You know, if there's uneven areas in the floor, you know, we're going to go in there and we're going to try to figure out how to even that out. Mm-hmm. But we're not trying to get higher level than that. We're not trying to dictate higher level direction than that. You know, let's just get this base level together here and solve that, because that's going to solve the most of the interoperability issues versus kind of living out on the edges.
Yeah. So be specifically at the moment, it's HDFS, Ambari, and Yarn.
Yeah. Right now, so what we have released in the runtime spec is HDFS, MapReduce, and Yarn. We have a separate spec for the operations side, which is centered around Embari, but it's not centered as much. So if you think of it from how an end user would look to consume or work with that, it's in the service definition layer level. So it's defining, hey, how can I install applications into a cluster? And so a lot of the focus as we look from a specification level is more of that, is sort of that piece of it. It's not necessarily the tool itself. The tool is a reference for how to do this, but certainly any tool that understands, you know, the Embari service definition language can just as well implement it.
And just coming back to the way you talked about the high velocity of a Apache project, since on the one hand, ODPI is supposed to set a base level, something that's stable and doesn't change too often, and on the other hand, you have the Apache velocity of innovation and changes and whatever. Going for maybe a roadmap for ODPI, how often do you think the recommendations you set forward are going to change, and then change not dramatically, but more than a comma? I mean, really has a change that a developer needs to take notice of?
We'll be doing releases of our specification twice a year is what our target is. As we look at doing new releases, we look to have them additive versus things that are, you know, entirely different from another. And so what I mean by that is, so we did a first release back at the end of March. As we look at a release here in the September-October timeframe, that would be more of, okay, assuming one, you know, let's take feedback and things that we've learned from one, and then let's build upon that and maybe also look to include, you know, a few more projects. So maybe here is an area where we look at saying, hey, is there specification work around SQL compliance, you know, Hive and Spark, for example, you know, things like that? Can we additively build those things in there? But we want it. If you look at the main target of our specifications, are people that are sort of looking for that long-term support, stable base, and so we're wanting to provide that as much as humanly possible.
Yeah. It's going to be up to the distributors also a little bit to be able to work with that stable base and more volatile top-level applications. Okay, in the meantime, Dave was able to rejoin us. Just for our listeners, Dave had some problems with his Skype, so he had to drop off, and now he's back. Hi, Dave.
Hey. Yes, the gods of chaos ate my Skype connection, but I battered them away, and I'm back now.
You're welcome back.
So, I mean, the ODPI, you mentioned as you were answering that previous question, the members of the ODPI a number of times, and I think the membership of the ODPI is kind of an interesting topic all of its own. You've got a really kind of varied, almost eclectic community of different people, you know, from, you know, traditional SIs, you know, Hadoop vendors, obviously, you know, people that I think of as almost being customers. You've obviously got kind of third party vendors. I mean, so I guess two questions. One is, do you think those are the main groups of members that I've picked up on? And secondly, what do you think each of those different groups gets out of ODPI membership?
As I look at the Hadoop ecosystem, I sort of bucket it into five categories. This isn't scientific at all. This is just this is me being sort of looking from the outside in. I see Hadoop distribution vendors as kind of have always been the focal point from a commercial standpoint of Hadoop. So the Cloudera, Hortonworks, those folks. You also have sort of a secondary group within there of vendors who are building components that fit within the cluster, but not full distribution. So DataTorrent, for example, is a great example there. And those are the folks really inside the cluster. As you move out, yes, you have these application vendors. So the analytics, the BI tools, the whatnot there, the SIs and the end users. You know, for us, that first group that ISVs, the application vendors, they're the ones that we see, and really everybody sort of downstream from that, they're the ones who traditionally not had a good way to engage at the direction of where Hadoop's going and and those really core Apache projects. And it's for a lot of the reasons I said earlier. I mean, they're just, that's not their focal point. They're not staffed for that. You know, they don't maybe necessarily the technical creds. I mean, it's a huge investment to put core committers on a key Apache project. So typically that's just not done. But, you know, they're also sort of stuck in this position here where that a lot of the work that's done there, they're dependent on it, right? So I see us, you know, just from our pure technical work, and I see our work probably evolving over time, our pure technical work, it's going to have a really nice three benefits for those groups there. You know, application vendors, this will help reduce costs for both development and QA by giving them stable bases to work from. SIs are going to be in the same exact category. And end customers, you know, this should also give them an assurance of, hey, if I can get my Hadoop cluster to be in an ODPI compliance standpoint, that will help me as I'm shopping for products to complement my investment here, that I can look for products that live up to this same level of quality, right? It's more of a declaration of, hey, this is a quality product here. This is one here that's designed in principles with how you should build Hadoop integrations. And that's a powerful beast there. And then as I look sort of from the upstream, you know, the natural upstream in the distro vendors and the component vendors, they're looking at it in an aspect of, here's natural opportunities for me to build my ecosystem out. And I think of this for smaller vendors, you know, the Hortonworks and the IBMs. I mean, they have natural partner teams that are going to be able to do this really effectively. But there's a ton of vendors that not many people have heard of. I mean, a really good one is a small company in Russia called Arena Data. Mm-hmm. They're building a Hadoop distro. They're making nice inroads in the Russian market. For them, the challenge is always going to be is building that ecosystem around it. And what we've seen the pattern in a lot of these developing markets is they're often get into this place where they have to be full stack. But the consumer of today is going to be heterogeneous by default. And so this sort of, this enables them to say, hey, you know what? I can tap into an ecosystem. I can come to these vendors and say, hey, you know what? You're ODPI compliant. We have a degree of ODPI compliant. But that helps break the ice there. And then that helps at least both of those companies recognize, hey, let's make an investment here and see if there's a market for working together. But that ODPI compliance piece is a key enabler in there. And we see a lot of this. I mean, you know, Russia, China, you know, Asia Pacific in general, there's just a ton of these providers in those regions that most of us have never heard of. But they're looking to, they're already either making great inroads in their markets, and or they're trying to break out or maybe break out into new geos. And ODPI can be a potentially nice enabler for that.
Excellent. Okay. Makes sense to me, at least.
Yeah. For me, I'm still kind of missing the middleware part because on the one hand, ODPI does lay the nice foundation, but that's a very low foundation. Mm-hmm. Most of the application vendors have a really high-level consuming application that kind of needs either an SQL engine or Spark or whatever you have it in between there. And that level is not being governed by ODPI. It's not under control of the developer of the application either. So it's still a bit of a chaos bottlenecking what they can do with their application there. How do you see that? Do you see that as that's fair and they should just figure that out? Or it's something you have to look at later? I mean, you talked already maybe to include Spark and SQL, but that's not always good or bad. So can you go a bit more in depth on that?
Well, I think sort of by your comment, you're probably thinking is, boy, ODPI, this isn't fair. Somebody should figure this out. Which is, I think, honestly, a fair way to look at it. There are still, yes, we're focusing on three components and there's 100 more. There are gaps. Over time, we'll be able to embrace this. And if I go back to our design philosophy, it's very focused on what can we do to make the greatest impact on the largest number of big data deployments? You've outlined SQL. I would agree with you. And I have a feeling a number of people in our membership probably agree as well. And I have a feeling also as well is if I would talk to these application vendors and I would say, hey, what's your biggest struggle point? They're probably going to come back with SQL. I mean, it sounds like from your experiences, SQL support, whether Hive or Spark, is a struggle point, correct?
Well, not Hive versus Spark, but the different kind of Hive, different kind of SQL engines you have in there. They have just slightly different SQL things that they support or not support. And if you take away the hurdle of the real bottom layer with ACFS compliance and YARN and everything, that's okay. Then that becomes the next hurdle to take, right?
Yep. Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. I mean, you know, SQL's had the beauty of being around for, you know, I don't know where you guys are at, but at least as old as I am. I'll be kind and say you're younger.
You'd be wrong, but go ahead anyway.
It's, you know, and that is always the natural like tool in the tool set. You know, that's like the hammer and nails here of the database. Mm-hmm. You know, the data programmer, right? Clearly any developer runs into SQL and finds out it's not, you know, ANSI or at least SQL 92 mm-hmm. compliant, you know, they're going to run to the hills.
Because SQL doesn't exist, right? Out there it's T-SQL or C-SQL or H-SQL or whatever SQL your little thing does.
I'm sure we could do an entire podcast where we lament about where SQL's gotten itself to, but I think we'll save the audience there. I would agree from an application vendor standpoint, I run too fast in the treadmill. But, you know, we want to see the things that are popping out here and say, hey, we've made three parallel roads. One of them has big potholes in it. The other is half made of asphalt and concrete. Can we make all of them mostly the same surface? You know, so I think that's sort of where our challenge is going to lie in there, and that's frankly been the area that's been really ignored by this ecosystem. I mean, and I don't mean that in a negative way. But when you're in innovation mode, those are the casualties that just naturally pop up, and that's okay. And I think we're in a unique position where we can help that. We can help solve a lot of the market questions around what Hadoop is, and give any organization really this base level expectation. If I'm encountering a Hadoop cluster, this ought to be here. These are things that I ought to expect. We're not going to ever probably cover absolutely everything because we're just not going to be able to keep up with that level of innovation. But I don't think the market needs us to.
Yeah.
I think vendors are going to be best suited to stay up at that curve.
Yeah, the one thing I'm still missing, though, is you, at the moment, if correct me if I'm wrong, you're kind of prescribing these components need to be there to be ODPI compliant, but you're not actually asking those things to interoperate with each other. Being a very cynical person at heart, Dave will attest, I could mm-hmm. just make my own completely alien dialect of Hadoop and just have those three RPMs in there, and hey, I'm ODPI compliant now, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you are. And
I was hoping for a no there, actually.
I can't say you're wrong. I mean, yeah, you could get, you know, Hadoop, HDFS, YARN, and then throw, like, for a real zinger, just Kafka in there randomly, right? Sure. But I think, you know, I guess over time, we're going to see that, hey, that combination of four things probably isn't going to be as popular as, you know, the combination of 15 to 18 components that the mainstream distros are doing today.
Well, let's make myself clear there, because my basic point was I could just include YARN, but not run it, not start it, not have it active in my dialect of Hadoop. But at that point, I would assume that the testing suite that you guys have developed would fail.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We try to catch all of the sneaky things.
Okay.
And frankly, you know, and this is going to be an area, and this is kind of where everybody's technical hat comes on of, I could find ways to game the system.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, any system is initially designed, somebody's going to find a way to game. Our position is, hey, take us feedback. If this isn't, you know, these things aren't, you know, etched in stone for the life of the world here. I mean, if this is not working well enough, we have, you know, anybody can go onto GitHub or into our Jira and do a pull request or do and open a ticket and say, hey, this doesn't make sense. Hey, you need to go into this. Hey, you need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can work to incorporate it. We can actually work with these people to help them commit it, right? I mean, participation at that level is just like an open source project. So It will evolve. It will, you know, try to capture that. So hopefully somebody sneakily just doesn't install the Yarn RPM and say, I've got Yarn installed. That's all you asked for, right? No, it actually has to work. That would be helpful.
But you're also trying to build this whole movement not from a top-down decree and you have to do, but more from bottom up. This is what you guys think should be a proper base, so that's what we're going to build specification to.
Yeah, and we're just trying to get broad input into that. And when I say broad, again, traditionally that's very been distro centric. We're trying to get ISVs and users participating in that. You know, because they're the ones that have to consume this stuff in the end, and so we just want to make it easy. Easy for them, easier for them to understand, and again, less of those sort of potholes and random stuff that pops up.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the how do you say that? Belaying my fear.
I'm trying to, you know, helping quell your fears, or at least for another day, right?
Yeah, but the one thing I'm hoping that ODPI is going to do for me, and I guess for Dave as well, because we're both in the pre-sales cycle of customer engagement, and we get a lot of RFIs, RFPs. So if you can just come to a date when we can just put in ODPI compliance and send it back, that would be great.
You know, we have a specification. You could do that now, and probably by the time this podcast goes to press, there'll be a number of ODPI compliant distributions out there. So,
okay.
You could do a good job for the cause and just sort of, you know, fill it in your template.
We can try. We can see if the customers agree with that.
No, I think that's it. I think we should just that's the only thing I'm writing in an RFP response anymore. It's just ODP compliant, big green tick, and a smiley face, and that's it. So send it back.
It brings me actually to a practical question. If I'm looking at a piece of software, how can I decide as a buyer that this thing is ODPI compliant?
So from a distribution perspective, the vendors will advertise it. But also the nice piece is our testing suite for the distribution. You can actually take that and run it against your cluster after it's deployed.
Yeah, but that's too late, right? It's when I go into the marketplace somewhere and I see a piece of software that does what I want it to do. And do you have a kind of a brand logo program?
We have all those. Yeah, we have branding assets in place. We're starting at the distribution level, and we're rolling out here over the coming months for the ISV level as well. Mm-hmm. Over time, I would expect us to, you know, have a directory here where you could search in there and find, okay, is this ODPI certified? Which components, you know, what ODPI level, what components is it using, sort of those matrix items there.
So me in my different life as a software developer, if I want to get into that list on your website, what should I do?
We'll be putting the process in place here over the coming weeks. For a distro side, you know, we have a GitHub repository that after you run our compliance tests, you can just submit our results and we'll evaluate them. And like I said, over the coming weeks, we're going to be putting the same piece or a similar process in place for ISVs as well. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the testing suite, actually, I mean, you kind of laugh that if I've already bought the thing, it's kind of silly now to check the 30-day compliant. But one of the quirks of deploying a Hadoop cluster is you can actually unvalidate the ODPI compliance in the process of installing. So this might be actually a useful thing for both of you in a pre-sales role is if a customer says, oh yeah, I'm ODPI compliant. I've bought Hortonworks, you know, 2.4 or whatever, you know, the version is that's ODPI compliant. You can call, you could call their bluff, but that's probably a little bit snarky. You could take the test suite and you could test it against their cluster and see, is this cluster really an ODPI compliance or not? Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing that as actually a useful tool for ISVs, probably not as much distros, but it's a useful tool for ISVs. So then they can come back and say, hey, you know what? There's a problem with compliance here. You need to talk to your distro vendor and get yourself into gear. And so as our test suite builds up there, I think that's going to be a very, very useful tool.
So that's more, I see it as useful from the point of a support, engagement where, customer XYZ is complaining that this stuff doesn't work. yeah, but you change the base stuff, so of course it doesn't work anymore, and I can prove it now by running the test.
Yep, yep. And you could also argue that it's useful in kind of like the post-sales, or even to a degree pre-sales, if you're just wanting to qualify things out. You could, if I'm an ISV, I could say, okay, let's do your ODPI compliance test on your cluster first before we continue this conversation, so we don't have to have the awkwardness later.
Yeah. Just management, expectation management, that's always a very important part.
Yep. Yes.
Now, are there any guarantees you guys provide? I mean, I bought something that's ODPI compliant, so now I'm legally, I don't know, entitled to certain stuff? Is that how it works?
Yeah. I mean, I would look at it very similarly to how, like, the cloud, like a Hortonworks or IBM partner program would work, right? This is a commitment between vendors. You know, certainly one of the things on the distro side is we want to ensure we don't force the distro vendor to say every one of your products must be ODPI compliant. We certainly encourage that, and we think what we specify shouldn't make it difficult to do that. But certainly distro vendors are well within the right to say, hey, we have one product line that's not ODPI compliant. We have one that is. But we ask that at least there is a product always on the market that's available for that. But we see this as sort of an ongoing commitment piece. So as, you know, like any software, if issues come up, we can help reintegrate that back in. And I think that's going to be important from the ISV side, because that's often the very difficult side to test, mm-hmm. you know, from a pure unit functional test standpoint. What we can do here is, hey, as customers bring up issues, the ODPI can be the forcing function to make sure that, you know, we get this resolved. We can either, you know, say, hey, ISV, you're actually doing something wrong, fix your product. Hey, distro vendor, you're doing something wrong, you need to fix your product in order to maintain that ODPI seal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think, you know, not quite our final question, our penultimate question is, you know, how can Hadoop vendors, Hadoop distributors, Hadoop packages, how do you see them still differentiating and still providing, you know, their own unique value while still conforming to the ODPI?
We don't specify. I mean, like I said, we focus really at a floor, not a ceiling. So, you know, there's new stuff coming out of out of the ASF incubation process related to Hadoop every 6 weeks. I mean, there's more than enough opportunities for them to add new projects, new commercial features, and whatnot, you know, very easily. And we fully expect that to, and we encourage that to happen. You know, that range of innovation is still going to happen. So I don't see us specifically preventing it, but I think the art of us not preventing it is effectively enabling it.
Yeah. I love that every 6 weeks something new emerges. I think that's a fantastic stat. I think it's a very scary stat at the same time, but you know, innovation is scary, change is scary, embrace it. Otherwise you're gonna get run over by it.
Yeah.
Okay, so final question now is, how would you describe Hadoop to someone who's never heard of Hadoop before?
You know what? That is a funny question, because I've been chatting with a few members around this, of saying, you know, if I were to point somebody to learn about Hadoop, would I point them to hadoop.apache.org or Hortonworks? And sometimes I sort of wonder if either of them are amazing choices at times. I guess I look at Hadoop as probably one of the biggest game changing, and I'm going to start to get into marketing speak here, so your audience is going to like hit the mute button on me. Okay, fine. I honestly see it as a game changing technology for helping get insight from the massive data that you're already sitting on and that you didn't know you could get insight and value from. So before this, I had a long stint at Sugar CRM, and one of the and spent time also leading the Open Social Foundation. And one of the pieces there, we weren't really deep in the big data side, but we were kind of more on the outskirts of, okay, after you've got all this data, what do you do with it? Sort of at that curve in the big data where a lot of the energy and focus was around the processing tools of big chunks of data. And then there was the big argument of like, really, what is big data? You know, is it a quantity and all of this? And I think there's been some good definitions that have come out of this. But I always found the interesting thing is the small data. The insight that once you get this data and you figure out something interesting from it, what is the insight and things that come from it? And I see that as kind of the ultimate value that's coming, you know, from Hadoop in general. You know, Hadoop is this engine for being able to extract insights, but at the end of the day, it's these applications at the kind of spokes of this. They're going to take those insights and able to produce great value.
Fantastic. All right. Well, you know, thanks very much for your time, John. Really appreciate it. I hope you've had fun. I've certainly had fun talking to you.
My goal in any podcast interview like that is if I can get the host to laugh, I'm doing something good. So,
yeah. If you've listened to our podcast before, we laugh a lot.
So. We're easy targets.
So apparently, that was a really low bar for me to get over. Basically, is what you're saying.
But you did, so that's fine.
Okay. Hey, you know, mission accomplished, right? No, this was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. It was a great kind of great conversation back and forth. And I hope your listeners appreciate it. I hope it didn't go too businessy on them, but it's been a lot of fun.
I will hear it in the feedback from them.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Excellent.
Thank you very much for this, John.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Cheers.
Cheers.
So in this last section of the podcast, we usually answer questions that we receive from you, our fabulous audience. However, in this particular case, I think we covered a lot of the questions that are aligned to this ODPI thing in the interview itself. We also didn't get any extra questions coming in that we could neatly tuck into this episode. So no questions from the audience in this episode, but please, if you do have something that you want to know about, use our Hadoopcast Twitter handle, go to roaringelephant.org and use our submit a question form, or you send an email to podcast@roaringelephant.org. I'd really like to thank John for his time.
We both want to do that.
I found the interview really interesting, and I think the ODPI holds some exciting promise. It's starting to, at least in my opinion, I think it's starting to deliver on some of the promise that's been talked about. It's not there yet. I think that's quite clear. But you know, there are some big names starting to form up behind it. You can see the roadmap for where they're heading with it. And it's just going to be a question of time, I think, as to how long it takes them to get where they're aiming for.
Yeah. I definitely want to thank John for really answering all our questions, because I did sneak in a couple of, well, maybe not so nice questions, and he was very open, very approachable there. So thanks a lot, John.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I think we owe it to our audience to ask those somewhat more difficult questions, because, you know, that's the kind of things that people really want to know. I mean, you can read all the high-level, the ODPI is fantastic stuff anywhere. But actually getting answers to some of the trickier questions, it's not quite so easy. So, yeah, definitely, John did a really nice job in answering even some of our more awkward questions.
Okay, and with that, we'll call it a podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this serving of bite-sized big data again. As usual, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, please go to www.roaringelephant.org, where you can find more information about this podcast, send us your questions, and please give us a 5-star review on iTunes, even though Dave still doesn't like iTunes. If you don't think you deserve the full 5 stars, that's fine too, but let us know why. Go to our website or send us an email to podcast@roaringelephant.org with any thoughts, comments, criticisms, or other feedback you might have. Until then, my name is John.
And my name is Dave.
I look forward to talking to you in 2 weeks' time. Goodbye.
Speak soon. Cheers.